Welcome back. Today on Behavioral Threat Analysis Center, Beyond the Bulletin. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dr. Kristen Schneider here with my co-host, Pete Lapp, and we're excited to welcome you to another episode of Beyond the Bulletin.
We made it to episode two. Like, we got through the pilot.
They didn't cancel us.
They didn't cancel us. We're still here. We're creating content. We got good stuff coming, and I'm just really happy to be in the same room with you.
It's nice to do this in person.
Yes, it's just so much better all the way around. So today, we've alluded to the fact that I'm a retired FBI agent, and we have a guest that is an absolute rock star.
Indeed.
They actually make movies.
Indeed, they
out
do.
Of the stuff that she does.
She's the inspiration for a lot of
really
that,
is
I think.
Really is. And I think that you know, when you think of profiler, mm-hmm. criminal profile, behavioral profiler, this is our guest is the kind of person that you should imagine fits that role and does that so well.
Yeah. Well, you know, I like to ask people what they wanted to be when they grew up, and I'll tell you, I wanted to be her.
Right.
When I grew up.
Right.
Right.
You want to be Clarice Starling, Silence of the Lambs, but to see someone and talk to somebody and have an opportunity to really get to know someone who has achieved that aspiration and is doing that day in and day out, dealing with some hard stuff. Heavy topics.
Very much so.
Not easy stuff to live with, but publishes, researches, consults on investigations, helps the good guys out, and is just a great, great inspiration to me personally as a retired FBI agent that, you know, to be able to finally work with and meet a real profiler. I know that sounds weird.
No, it's a great opportunity, and I'm excited to talk to her as well. You've got the FBI background in common. She and I have the clinical psychology background in common, and we're both really passionate about behavioral science research, which I'm really excited to talk with her about today as well.
But hold on a second.
We've got somebody
else. We've got another special guest
here.
We
do. We've got all kinds of special guests today.
We do. And making her podcast debut. We talked last week about our boss's boss's boss.
That's right.
This is our boss. Brandi Hutchings is our boss, and she's our new boss, but she is in the room with us live.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me come out. I'm going to enjoy meeting our new guest and hearing all things BTAC.
We are so excited to have you. Thank you. And so let me set the stage real quick. I got to do some cooking. We started thinking about the best first guest that we could have. Like, who's the rock star who comes in from the top rope and just knocks it out of the park?
Blows everybody out of the water.
First episode. Yep. We wanted to, like, hit a really good topic with a great, great first special guest. So Dr. Kerry Gibson, mm-hmm. We have one rule here at the Beyond the Bulletin podcast is that we get the doctor out of the way first.
Indeed.
And then we transition to, like, first names. If you don't mind, Kerry, Dr. Gibson, I want to say the rock star part is twofold here with Kerry. Not only is she an FBI agent, she's also a profiler. And we're gonna unpack that a little bit because we haven't really introduced ourselves to our audience yet enough. I am a retired FBI agent.
Yeah.
And I, like, am enamored with the profiler folks that movies and TV and media have made into this whole thing a big deal. But I never got to work with them when I was at the FBI. So I'm kind of like, this is, like, very cool for me. Because this is, like, one of the only times I've ever had a chance to really sit down and talk to a real live FBI profiler. So, Kerry, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you guys so much. I appreciate that. Very kind of you to say all those nice things. I'm just happy to be here to be able to help you guys get the message out for what you want to discuss today, which is obviously very important topics that we at the FBI's BAU find very important as well.
So before we get into the topic of humiliation, I want to go back a little bit, and I'm curious because every time I meet an FBI agent and I have a chance to sit down and talk with them, I want to know, and I think Kristen, you want to know too. Walk us back through the moment in your life when the light bulb went on and you said, oh, FBI agent.
That's what I want to do. Did you always know?
No, I didn't. I didn't always know. I was active duty military. I was an active duty Air Force psychologist. And I had been, almost 3 years into that. And I had a year left my time in the Air Force. And I was at that moment trying to figure out what my next steps were going to be.
Sure.
And the military is a great place to be. I love the military. I love being a part of the Air Force, but I was tired.
Yeah.
I was tired because of, again, we do more with less all the time. And the traditional kind of psychologist role, I found that I was looking for something different. So I started to think, what can I do with my skill set? What makes sense? How can I still be very, helpful in helping individuals? But what does this look like? And at that moment in time, I started to look at the FBI and at the FBI's BAU, and I started to think about, well, if I, I've been using my psychological skills to help people, right? Yeah. Which I love, and that's great. Those traditional psychological skills like therapy, assessment, all awesome, glad to have. But what if I use those skills to catch bad guys? Could I do that? And is that something that would make sense? And for me, it's something I found very interesting because I'd worked in a prison before I went into the military.
You had?
Yes, yes. So with civilly committed sex offenders. So,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I also worked briefly with sex offenders. Unusual part of the trajectory as psychologists, but I imagine you had some interesting experiences there as well.
Very much so, but also like very much solidifying criminal behavior.
Yes.
And the why behind that, and why does it take, an offender to perpetrate those crimes so many times before they're held accountable in those ways? And so I was already fascinated by that from that background. And so then when I started to look at, gosh, I could kind of merge this together, right? I have my psychologist skills. I could, become join the FBI and see if I could become a profiler. I found out early on in the process that it's a long process, that you have to be an agent first and foremost. It doesn't matter your psychologist. There's no quick pass to get to the BAU. It's actually 8 to 10 years of an effort as an active FBI agent. And so I started at that moment to try to think, well, what would this look like and what could I do? And that kind of started that progression for me, ultimately joining the FBI. Now I've been in the FBI over 19 years.
Wow.
And I've been at the FBI's BAU over 10. And I've, in that space, a profiler actively for 7 years before I took on the role of the unit chief leading my unit in preventing targeted violence and terrorism.
So the ambition to become an FBI agent and the ambition to become a profiler for you, They kind of went hand in hand right from the beginning. It's not like I want to be an agent and then you kind of grew into it, you met a profiler, maybe you were influenced in some other way. Those two came together at the same time for you.
Absolutely. Fascination with true crime, fascination with criminal thinking and criminal behavior. I read all John Douglas's books, as everybody who wants to be a profiler did, or anyone who's interested in that. And just found all of that extremely interesting. And then also, having a specific skill set as a psychologist, there's a lot that you can do with that in those traditional paths. But I found that I really was kind of yearning for something different and something more operationally based. And so it really fit the bill for that.
So how long into your career were you able to then get into the BAU? 10 years?
Yeah, no, 8 years. So I was an FBI agent in Minneapolis division
Minnesota,
which I'm originally from Minnesota. So shout out to all the Minnesotans out there. But I definitely, loved being an FBI agent, but really wanted to continue to pursue the potential of being an FBI profiler. So it was 8 years in as an FBI agent before I got selected to become an SSA, a supervisory special agent with the FBI's BAU-1, or at that time it was BAU-2, but basically the unit that has the mission for preventing acts of targeted violence.
Wow. So, I know that, okay, this is a dumb question, but I have to ask it. How much did Silence of the Lambs influence you? Like the Jodie Foster, Clarice Starling. How much? I know it's a dumb question, but it's like.
No, I mean, I like that movie.
Right? It's just, I mean.
Yeah, I like that movie. Yeah, no, I, again, it was all, it's all very interesting. Yeah. Hollywood makes it, you know, very interesting. And for me, again, the criminal mind and yeah. that behavior piece for me, I just found very fascinating. And really this wanting to understand more about why people behave the way that they do.
Brilliant movie. And it's kind of funny because having been through the new agent training at Quantico, for you know, I think you're going to agree with this. It's so realistic because it's filmed there. We walked through those dribble tunnels, and you know, that was the same, you know, the gray T-shirt with the FBI stitch. When I went through, that was it. And we both know there's absolutely no way, as a brand new training agent. You're not being pulled into a major serial killer investigation
You're telling us it doesn't happen.
It doesn't happen that way. No, that's the Hollywood.
You have to have some experience and training under your belt.
Yeah.
But you know, it's interesting because we all do need models, and I think as a psychologist in training, you know. My guess is this wasn't a path that was laid out for you, right? Some of the things that were considerations were probably things like doing clinical work and maybe some research. And certainly you get to do some of that, but you really had to sort of forge your own path here. It sounds like kind of having to look for models of this, maybe finding them along the way, whether it's from film and TV or things that inspire us initially or the colleagues that we meet along the way. Yeah. Was there anybody early on that influenced you that got you excited about this field?
Yes, I mean, from you're absolutely right in the sense that we see all this on the TV and it seems like it should be so easy. And when I was looking at it, my initial kind of thought was, well, gosh, there's got to be need for a psychologist at the BAU. Why wouldn't there be? And as I started to pull that thread to figure that out, found out really fast that's not a routine, you know, aspect. And so for me, I had originally talked to Greg McCreary, who is a retired FBI mm-hmm. profiler who was there at the time. And it was just by happenstance that I was able to connect with him because he was actually teaching a course. And so I had the opportunity to connect with him. And he's the one who shared with me, if you want to be a profiler, you have to be an FBI agent. Hands down, no shortcuts. You have to be able to do that. And so you really need to ask yourself, is that what you want to do?
Because it's that's no a small commitment.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's a law enforcement officer. Yeah. Do you want to be a law enforcement officer? Because that's going to be number one. And then the potential to get a BAU is number two. And you may not ever get there. Like, it's very competitive. It's very realistic, which I appreciate it. And so as I went through that process, it took about 2 years of me going through the application process to do that. And so in that meantime, as I'm going through that, I'm continuing, obviously, to learn and research and find out as much as I can about it. And everything, obviously, still seemed like it definitely aligned with what I wanted to do. And then as I went into it, I found out really fast, like you're saying, like it's unique, right? And I can remember being at the academy and doing knuckle push-ups in the gravel and being like, I have a doctorate to do this.
How did I find myself here?
Yes. What am I doing? And I want to do what and why am I doing this, right? Yeah. And constantly kind of being pushed. But what I found in that moment is that the FBI Academy really taught me that we all have perceived limits.
Yeah.
And we just have to push through those perceived limits. And I was able to do that in the Academy and succeed and get to my first field office, which was Minneapolis. And I think in that process, there was never really like a strong psychologist in the beginning that I connected with in that way. So you're very accurate in saying it's a different path, and there wasn't very many before me.
Yeah.
Once I got to BAU, I encountered, you know, another psychologist that was there. There was two there at the time that were FBI agents and a psychologist. But it's very rare that you have what I would call dual hatted, that you're in that role. Also had the great opportunity to work with Dr. Kirk Kennedy.
Yep.
He was there as a civilian psychologist.
One of our BTAC team members.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, for me, it was a wonderful time to be able to work with Kirk, because here I was in this law enforcement space as a psychologist who's a law enforcement officer and kind of trying to fit. And so I had him as a peer model once I got to BAU, just to another psychologist to be around, which was nice.
Yeah.
And I very much appreciated that.
So at the BAU, what is the ratio of psychologists versus non-psychologists? Right?
Tell us a little bit more about your team. What does your team look like? We talked in our first episode about the fact that our team is really kind of modeled after yours, but there's also some really important differences.
Yeah, absolutely. So our team is what I would call multidisciplinary, multi-agency.
Yeah.
And that's really where our strength comes from and how we are able to come together and solve these complex problems in very creative ways. And so on my team, when I first got there, I was the only actual agent / psychologist that was a part of the team. And so, you know, on a team, if you want to say about, you know, 25 people, like on, you know, any given day, there's myself. Now on our team, we have the great fortune of having another dual-hatted psychologist and agent, but she's an agent with OSI,
that's
Air
right.
Force OSI, Dr. Melissa Stormer. And so it's great to have her, but you know, she hasn't always been there. We were able to get her on in the last several years to be a part of our program. And so there's two of us in our Behavioral Threat Assessment Center, BTAC, for the FBI's BAU, so that's great. But outside of that, it's very limited. And so right now, the only other psychologist is Dr. Nicole Cruz, who took Dr. Kirk Kennedy's position in another BAU unit, BAU 2.
So we have a saying at the BTAC, our psychologists have a saying, it's actually funny. I am a psychologist, but I'm not your psychologist. Is that something that you have to use at the FBI?
Do you have to remind your colleagues? We have to remind Pete sometimes.
That's funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I think everybody is, you know, I have a great team to work with and everybody really kind of understands what our mission is. And so I get asked a lot of great questions. And as you can imagine, at the FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit, you get exposed to a lot of very unique elements and criminal behavior that you really can't talk about on, you know, at dinner time.
Right.
save that thought for the end, because we do have an interesting question, I think, about that and how you process and manage that. So you mentioned the why about why people commit crime. And I think, you know, I will be honest, in my career, I was thinking more of who, what, when, where, how, and then but the why was not necessarily, I didn't really care from an investigative perspective, because if you met the elements of the crime, that was really what I was kind of focused on.
And that's why we have these multidisciplinary teams, right? As the psychologist, I'm always most interested in the why.
Right,
that's
right.
Where I always start from.
Right, right. And the why for me has become more interesting, and I've been more curious about it in my post-FBI career. But with humiliation, you know, we picked this as a bulletin topic, and our colleague Ian came up with this topic, which I thought was really great and something that I had not really thought of tremendously amount of time, how humiliation kind of affects people and lingers. You know, where's your experience with humiliation? And why do you think it's such a lasting, do we call it an emotion? Is it an emotional response? What is humiliation to you?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that it's very significant because of that lasting impact that it has on people that have been exposed to that. And all of us can go back to different times in our lives or different experiences where we have been absolutely publicly humiliated. Mm-hmm. And you can still kind of feel it. You know, you can probably even like close your eyes and be right there again. And it's awful because it's had such a lasting impact on us. When I first started looking at this topic as part of the research project at the FBI's BAU, what I found so interesting about it is when we're in this space of trying to prevent terrorism or targeted violence and kind of looking at this, you're trying to figure out like what can you do early and often to prevent that progression to violence? How can you understand that? And so we had been, you know, going through all this and looking at it. And what we realized when we first started to kind of learn more about humiliation and this topic is that the reason why our jobs are so hard is when you look at individuals who commit acts of targeted violence, and then you look at individuals who have been, you know, contemplating violence or been on the pathway to commit violence and haven't, they look a lot alike.
Yeah.
And so for all of us out there, the worker bees trying to kind of go through and get rid of the noise and understand what we have, it made sense when we started to see this because there's a lot of similarities between those two groups. So from our point of view, we're like, how can we focus in on what really matters? Because if I can find one thing that matters, then I have the impact to invoke some type of proactive change. And humiliation is what emerged out of that research.
Yeah. Wow.
And so for us, it finally was, you know, a factor, you know, and that's what I would say. It's a factor. It's experience that is very relatable to everybody.
Yes.
We all understand when you say humiliation or I ask you to think about a time that you were humiliated, you can remember it. And it helps start to be able to connect those dots for understanding the why for the progression to violence.
I like the way you just described it as an experience. And you asked if it was an emotion. I think it's more than just the emotion, right? It's more than just embarrassment, right? We've all had the feeling of being embarrassed or doing something embarrassing. Humiliation, we get that sort of added layer of there's some feeling of intentionality, right? Some other person or entity involved that is perhaps doing this to us. Right. So there's also kind of an attribution as well. It's not just a feeling. It's also an understanding and a way of making sense of your experience.
It's very for the person who is perpetuating that humiliating event. It's very purposeful.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think that that's part of the reasons why it's so lasting is it's people in whatever moment being driven to publicly humiliate somebody, there's really no good that will ever come out of that. There's no legitimate purpose for that other than to make someone feel bad, to make someone feel ashamed, to make someone feel, you know, like they don't matter and we don't care. And so when we look at understanding that, you know, that experience, the emotions that are there is really, you know, that the person starts to feel that shame, that embarrassment, you know, and then anger.
Yes.
Can come from that.
I want to read something from the bulletin we wrote because I think it resonates. While we might think of humiliation in the context of immature adolescent bullying, in adulthood, it can lead to resentment. And most importantly, from an insider threat perspective, can fuel a powerful grievance.
Yes.
I was bullied in high school by a guy, and that guy is, like you said, there's a personal aspect to it, and he is the face of the humiliation that I felt from that bullying. And it came from adolescence. I mean, we were like sophomores in high school, freshman year of high school,
sure,
all the way through, quite frankly, until I graduated.
But that stuff sticks with you.
It sticks with you. Like, why does it stick with us for so long? And I'm not asking you to be my psychologist, I promise you. I've already talked to people about this professionally, but like, why does it stay with us for so long? Why does it linger?
You know, this is part of the life experiences that shape us, right? If we change our behavior, we make different choices based off of it. When we've been exposed to a traumatic experience, it actually burns, you know, into our brain, that traumatic experience, right? And so it's everlasting and stored there. We decide what we do with that.
Yeah.
Do I take that humiliation and do I use it to propel me forward to a position over that person who is bullying me? Do I take that as a challenge to show them who I really am and the strength that I have inside to prevail? Or do I cower? Do I avoid? Do I make choices that ultimately fuel more resentment and anger? It all really depends on what you have for your own personal resources and support for what choices you make in that area. And that's where I feel in this in what we do, right, on our multidisciplinary, multi-agency team, like I talked about, all of us coming together with those different perspectives and different experiences. We have both the law enforcement side, we have crime analysts, intel analysts, we have, you know, our task force officers that are coming in from different federal agencies. We're coming all together to look at this role, the different optics that we bring that include our experiences, our knowledge, our thoughts of what can we do to make it better, right? And then that's where that creativity comes together to get somebody to higher ground, to help them understand you do have the strength to prevail, you do have the strength to overcome. I don't know that we, before this research that we were able to work on before, in that place, we always thought probably that, you know, humiliation isn't good, right?
Right. Sure.
But we didn't understand how pivotal it was to prevention. And I think that is where now we hang our hat on in our unit to what are things that we can do. And hey, by the way, I get what you're saying about an option, but there is humiliating drivers that could potentially be connected to that. And part of what happens is people don't think about that. And not to be mean or to perpetuate a negative experience for someone, but they get so solution focused on keeping people safe or following policy or process that they lose sight of the individual experience of what it's like to go through that. So, for example, if you you come to the attention of a school district and you're a student as a potential person of concern, they may want to search your belongings before you go to school.
Yeah.
They can do that in a very private way, or they can do it in a very public way. And that's a perfect example of where someone's, how they can be thought about in an individual way, in a real human person way, and then be able to think about how can we keep that humanity, that person intact, you know, for how what they need and what they're seeing and they're experiencing. How can we make sure that we don't make this worse?
Yeah.
And their identity too, not just their humanity, but their identity. We've had instances where cases that we've looked at where individuals, because their risk is risen to a point of concern, they're no longer allowed on base. And they're normally functioning people who are, you know, have a great reputation, and they can't go, and they're stopped, and there's like, no, you can't come on base, and there's an identity like, wait a minute, it's kind of a degree of humiliation, or they're kicked out of their job, the service, or whatever, and that in itself could be something, because the identity that they have with the uniform, with the being a Marine, being a soldier, being an airman kind of thing.
And so much of it, you're right, is what the way that these things are done, the process, the methods, the way that people feel that they're treated.
Yeah, you know, and I think that that is where the research is so important, because one of the things that we found is that individuals that went on to commit acts of targeted violence, you know, as we've talked about, they experienced humiliation. And that was obviously one of those key factors that we honed in on. But with those individuals that went on to commit an act of targeted violence after they had experienced the humiliating event, those individuals were 4 times more likely to experience humiliation. And now I think this is a great place for future research to really kind of hone in on that, because what does that mean?
Yes.
From my perspective, it's highlighting, is there a potential perception that could be skewed for individuals where they are potentially more sensitive or potentially have a perspective that's different than you or I, and therefore a regular kind of interaction that wasn't intended to be humiliating is perceived as humiliating.
Yep.
And that's, I think, is very a very important piece for us to think about when we're doing this, because if you're in the military or you're, you know, working in the community or you're working in private sector related to threat assessment threat management, and you're encountering somebody that you're concerned about, well, one, like I said, we don't want to make it worse, but we also want to understand there could be sensitivities or vulnerabilities to that person that ultimately, you or I, it's not how we would see it. It doesn't matter how we see it. It's how do they see it. So if they say that was humiliating, even if
that's what matters,
even if that wasn't your intention, That's what matters, the fact that they said it was humiliating, yeah. And then we have to try to fix it. But it comes down to, if we're going to boil it down to something everybody can understand and do, it's kindness.
Yeah.
It's be kind. Recognize that you don't know what everybody is carrying. You don't know what their struggles are. People don't broadcast that. And so if you come from a place of first being kind and not assuming that everybody's like you, I think that that's easy. And if we did more of that, we would definitely, I think, have people adjusting better and being able to overcome some of those vulnerabilities.
Yeah. Kristen wants to get into the research.
I do.
I know you're just like, I see you. See you looking at your computer. You're going, I want to be in the
research.
Well,
it's just, how often do you get an opportunity like this?
I mean, she's published.
I mean,
repeatedly.
She's got so much stuff just from this year that I want to talk about. But really, you've published several new empirical studies on targeted violence using some innovative tools. And you've also done some recent work with the active shooter database. Can you tell us about some of your recent research findings? What are you most excited about? I know some of it does, in fact, tie into humiliation. One of the items that we highlighted in the bulletin was that finding that you had about that folks being four times more likely to have experienced a humiliating event. But there's a whole lot more that you found as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for your interest. For us, so and specifically with the humiliation, you know, as I stated, we know that that occurred with individuals that went on to commit acts of targeted violence. But when you were able to identify those humiliating events, we found that those humiliating events occurred within 2 years of the attack. And so, again, you're looking at, not years of humiliation that's happened for someone, but there is that potential for within the last 2 years that it could then progress on to that violent outcome.
Which is interesting because it means recent, but not necessarily yesterday. Humiliation is something that the response to it tends to build and grow, and it can really fuel that grievance.
Absolutely. I think it comes back to that grievance.
Yeah.
And that's so important, is to be understanding how significant that is for that person and be able to ask those questions. You know, a grievance can be a slight, it can be a humiliation, it can be an injustice, it can be a wrong. But a lot of times we find that there is a grievance that's building. And, you know, I think the interesting aspect about that, it comes back to, you know, resiliency, and it comes back to how people cope with stress and challenging situations. Because if you or I are in a position where maybe we are going to put all of our you know, cards on this outcome, and we really want this scenario to come true for us, if it doesn't, we have a backup plan. Okay, I didn't get that college, I'm going to go to this other college, no big deal, right? But somebody who is, you know, more prone to progress along that pathway because of a grievance is somebody who lacks that inability to really bend, right?
Yeah.
They're more brittle.
Yeah.
And they become fixed and focused on that grievance, and they can't move past it. And it's very alive and true to their everyday, where you and I, okay, yeah, that didn't turn out how we wanted, but let's just move on and go on to something new. So we find that there's that that individual struggles with that ability to bend and to move into a positive direction. I think the other aspect, with this, we have research working on right now to see if where they did the active shooter attack, was that connected to the actual humiliating event? We don't have that completed yet, but I'm really curious to see where that's going to go for our research in the future.
I'm so interested in that because humiliation is very public, right? I mean, it tends to happen with other people around, and it can be just one person or it can be multiple people. But are you seeing that even in your casework? Do you see that some of the reaction to being humiliated when someone engages in targeted violence, is it, again, in that sort of public arena? Is it an attempt to maybe address that humiliation?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that we question and we wonder about a lot is, you know, does that public humiliation, that experience, drive that need for public retribution?
Yeah.
And so I think there's definitely a potential for that. More research needs to be done. But when we look at it, we've really started to look if you think about humiliation as that kind of umbrella, we start to really look at what are the spokes under that umbrella. And shame is really having a significant aspect of that, that shame and anger. And, you know, we've talked with our partners and we talked about, you know, really is that infamy, does that become an antidote to shame, right? So if I take this humiliating event and it drives that need for that public retribution, is that how I make it? Is that how I turn that shame around? Is that how I come back? Is that how I take back the control? Is mm-hmm. through a violent attack that's done in a very public way that ultimately ensures notoriety or fame of some sort for me, which now I've flipped that script, right? Yeah. Now I'm a somebody versus a nobody.
Yeah. And how I'm the one in control. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. So more research needs to be done on that, but I think there's absolutely elements of shame that are very important for us to understand what that means and how to work people through processing that shame in a productive and healthy way versus a non-productive way for them that ultimately just builds that grievance, right? It just adds fuel to that grievance.
Indeed.
I also think that when we're looking at this and understanding more about the progression of violence, our team recently had the opportunity to put out a Beyond Belief resource that really focuses on understanding the radicalization process and violent extremism. But in that work, we really, it's kind of paramount to what we do at the BAU, is really that individualized approach and really understanding that a lot of these drivers to these behaviors start with unmet needs. And so if we can understand what someone's unmet needs are, that starts to help us create a roadmap for that mitigation, for, you know, addressing this in a positive way, for creating more protective factors for that person. And so we're really excited to build more upon that and to really understand. I think at the end of the day, there's not a cookie cutter approach to this. And so we really have to always focus in on the individual and understanding the why behind the way that they're feeling or the behaviors that they're perpetrating.
Well, that's along the lines of the threat management part of threat assessment, threat management. It's nice to, we can't just admire the problem and go, wow, that's really interesting and fantastic research. And
assessment is important, but you got to do something.
We got to do something with it and manage that risk. And I think that's more building towards that pathway to give risk owners, stakeholders, options to manage the risk. Because this is, you know, with your research showing that there's a festering of these humiliating acts that take as long as 2 years, that's a long strategy from a management perspective and difficult.
But it's also a lot of opportunity to intervene.
It is. Absolutely. You're thinking positive. I like your positivity. Yes.
You got to try, right? I'm also glad you brought up Beyond Belief, though, because I think it's a great resource and it's something that folks, anybody who's listening to this can find it online. It's on the FBI webpage and you can go and you can get a copy of it.
FBI.gov.
You know, obviously the general public does not get to see all the cases that get better. They don't get to see all the bad outcomes that are prevented.
Yes.
Where our team does, we get to actively be a part of that process, to actively advocate to take that person to higher ground. And that's an incredibly hopeful experience for us to be a part of. So from our side, we see an incredible amount of hope out there when you see people respond to something as simple as kindness, you know, as someone being kind to them, what that means. As simple as being heard, you know. So many times we hear people that they're just overlooked. They just feel like they're invisible, and you know. So how do we address that? How do we help them feel important and like they matter to everybody? And so I feel like in our casework, what we found is incredibly complex, you know, set of facts and incredibly challenging circumstances.
Layers
of risk factors. We found that through a long-term approach, team approach of actively going together to look at what is that person's deficits and how can we address it, and very strategically taking time and energy to hit one deficit at a time to help get that person molded into molded into a person that's stronger, that has more resiliency, has more options and support. to then make better choices, you know, as they're maturing and growing into different areas of their life. So for us, those cases have been incredible. But one thing I will tell you about humiliation is that it doesn't matter who you are, what you've been exposed to, or the resources you have. When you talk about humiliation and you ask someone, have you ever been humiliated before? Tell me about that. They can recite that in a place of clarity because of that trauma that goes with that experience.
Doesn't matter how long it's been.
It doesn't. And it's like they're back on that stage and they're being humiliated again. And so I think that that's one of the key, although it's obviously very important for us from a mitigation standpoint to know that, it's also a key way to build a bridge to someone. It's a key conversation to have that starts to unlock and open doors for people who are pretty used to closing those doors, right? And feel like that's their only option. And I just think that's important. The other aspect I will tell you that's important with these cases that we've seen great movement into a positive direction is just having those real conversations in an appropriate way that really focuses in on that individual and their unmet needs. And so asking the question specifically related to who's not listening to you?
Yeah.
That opens a door. I had the great opportunity to talk. I talk with these offenders that commit these acts of targeted violence through our research. And one of those offenders that I had talked to told me that as a 16-year-old, in that moment, he was very closed off from having any conversations from anybody about what was going on. But if somebody would have asked him, who is not listening to you, he had a lot to say. And he would have definitely shared in that moment. And I think that that has stayed with me as something, again, so simple, so easy for us to do, but very impactful.
That question is brilliant, because I am assured that being asked that question, that receiver is going to go, oh, wow, you see my soul. Mm-hmm. You know me. I would think from a rapport perspective, that just built a huge amount of rapport. Like, that person now feels seen because you've asked such a pointed question that hits home. Because everyone has someone in their lives who we can say, you're not listening to me. But clearly, if you've got this grievance, it's strong.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. a strong, that's a great, great question.
And that is one of the unmet needs, is to be heard, right? To be understood, to be seen.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
Absolutely.
In terms of this field of targeted violence prevention, what are the things that you are most worried about, but also what are the things that you're most hopeful about?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I've been working in the threat assessment management space for almost over 10 years, like I said, and I what I find just absolutely, you know, and very intriguing is the fact of how that space has evolved in my 10 years in it, the changes that have happened. I can still remember some of my first cases that I had the opportunity to work, and how different that threat picture looks today. I think number one, for all of us, we need to realize that the threat will continue to evolve, and we need to be nimble, and we have to be able to bend ourselves, and to be flexible in what we're gonna do. And that's why that creativity is such a huge part of threat management, is we have to recognize that this is a moving, you know, picture for us. And if we're not nimble, if we don't evolve with the threat is gonna always be ahead of us. And so I challenge everybody to think about that and think about how can you do better, how can you do more in that space, because we need everybody in that. I also feel that as we're looking at that, if I look over the last, 10 years in this space, it is, like you said, there is a lot to be hopeful for that I've seen. I think the research drives a lot of that, because we can't go by a gut feel. We have to understand through actual validated, research, what are the factors that we need to hone in on so we can be smart about it.
Yeah.
like if humiliation wouldn't have come up as a factor for us to focus on, we wouldn't have focused on it other than in general kind of concept way. But we know that it matters. So therefore, we can really hone in on that yep. in a very kind of surgical way that I think is important. So there's that aspect of it. I feel like for all of us right now that are in the threat assessment management space, there's a huge responsibility to help build psychological resiliency, to help us, to help others have the skill set to deal with life. There is a lot of people out there that do not have the psychological armor to deal with life yep. and become overwhelmed. Yeah. And as soon as they become overwhelmed, they become suicidal. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. Mm-hmm. If somebody becomes overwhelmed and they want to hurt themselves or hurt somebody else, that is a real problem. And it's on all of us around that see that happening to help give them more tools in their toolbox. One of the key factors that we've seen from the research that is absolutely paramount, and I think we will continue to see build as this threat picture evolves, is the link between suicidality and homicidality.
Yes.
And in my unit, we talk a lot about that. The research shows that that's there. Over half of the individuals that committed acts of targeted violence experienced suicidality first. That was wow. their first experience. Wow. And all those ones who experienced suicidality first, 70% of them in the year prior to the attack had some type of suicidal ideation or suicidal behavior. So we see it as kind of a gateway. It doesn't mean that everybody who's suicidal is going to become right. homicidal. That's no. not what I'm saying.
Right.
But individuals that make that choice to progress to a homicidal act, we know that in many cases it starts first with that individual feeling hopeless and helpless, overwhelmed, and suicidal.
Leap. It's not a big no. leap between the two.
No, no. So we say all the time, suicide prevention is homicide prevention.
It is. Yeah.
And I think that that's important. So as you know, people that are actively out in the communities working, I know we can sometimes become desensitized to suicidal yeah. threats. But again, we have to recognize that it's a cry for help. People are you kind of waving that red flag. I have issues that I don't know how to deal with. I don't know what else to do in this situation. And so that, I think that's a huge part. And I think if we helped address that, then we would be even more stronger in a positive way. So I hope as time goes on over these next years, that that's something that we can really hone in on building that psychological armor and being able to put more tools in their toolbox for how to deal with life. Because if we don't do that, then we're not giving them the ability to thrive. We were actually setting up the scenario for a bad outcome. And that's an important factor for us.
You used a really interesting word that I rarely hear from government folks, and I throw myself in that picture as well, creative.
Oh, yeah.
It's not often like we don't think of government and creativity, right?
But threat management has got to be a creative endeavor, doesn't
it? But I never thought of it that way. Like, I figured there's a script and, like, it's you apply this person, or every person is unique, and, you know, we want to make them telework from home, whatever. I never thought of it from the creative perspective. And to me, creativity is always inventing new ideas to apply to a particular problem. So I just thought it was a really interesting word that I thought.
I like it though. I think behavioral threat assessment and management is as much an art as it is a science.
I've
right?
heard that somewhere.
I think actually, there's some real yeah. truth to that. And I think when we do it well, we are really addressing people as individuals, and that requires some creativity. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach that's going to work for everyone. And that can be challenging, particularly within a government realm where we have SOPs and we have ways of doing things that you know, folks want yeah. them to be the same every time.
You're going to see that sentence in a future bulletin.
I'm almost
certain. I have to say, like, we've been talking about that sentence because we're writing a bulletin now on threat management.
And yeah.
I've said this is more of an art than a science. We can't apply an algorithm to an individual and say this will be the outcome if we do the algorithm. It's art to a degree how we manage this risk. And that's the challenge because sometimes you color outside the box. Yeah. And
you want standardization.
Yeah.
At the same time, right. you want a repeatable, defendable process. That's why we use structured professional judgment tools yep. in our assessments. And you have to also be willing to think really creatively. Can you think of any times, or are there times where you've had to come up with really creative mitigation strategies that, you know, you felt like you had to pull out of your back pocket to deal with something that was a one-off type of a situation.
You know, creativity is interesting because I think sometimes some of our suggestions aren't incredibly creative, but they are outside the box. Mm-hmm. They're outside the norm. They're outside of that process.
Yeah.
So for example, if somebody, you know, is trying to get their, let's say, bachelor's degree, right? And they're one class away from it and they run out of money to do that. And then they start to spiral because they have other issues. Yeah. And that comes to our attention. Is there ways we can creatively help that person get out of that and get that degree, which ultimately then could get to higher ground? In cases like that, and sometimes we'll have like, well, you know, they owe this much money, or they have these many factors that they have to complete. They have to do 20 points, these 20 points to address these issues before we're going to budge. We always ask, do we need all 20?
Right.
Can we boil these down? You know, if they can't do something in person, is there a virtual option? Can we have flexibility here to have the outcome? I once had an interesting conversation with somebody about, you know, a potential termination of an employee, and then looking at that and what were options that they had.
Time when potentially how you handle it could lead to humiliation.
Have you ever thought about helping in a moment? Like, if this person is no longer a fit for your organization, is there anything you can give them that helps this be a little bit less devastating? You know, so do you have the means and ability to have, you know, some type of soft landing, some type of, you know, severance package that will help them be able to get to higher ground? And it's not that people, I think, are overly rigid with different things. I just think that sometimes we don't think about it in a different way. We've had other cases where really we have to like individually focus on what drives that person in a positive direction. And there's many times where people aren't asking those questions. And so we will ask a question of like, well, before all this happened, right, before we got to this space that we're in right now, if we were to go back, you know, what was going on before the dominoes started to fall in their life? What did that time and period look like? What are key factors that were important to them that kept them, anchored that we can recreate? It's much like if you think about if you've ever struggled with depression, if you think about when someone is depressed, there's certain things you stop doing.
Right.
Well, as a psychologist, I would ask my patients, okay, so when you weren't depressed, what did you find joy in doing?
Yep.
Oh, well, I'd work out every day. I would write. I'd read. I'd hang out with my friends. I'd do this. Well, can we start doing that again? Well, what do you mean to start doing it? I was like, can you just start doing it again? Because we know it's like anything. Once you get to the gym, you're not going to turn around and go back home.
Right.
Just get to the gym if that was something that was helpful to
you. An order of operations. You don't have to feel better in order to do those things. If you do those things, it can actually lead to feeling better.
Absolutely.
Well, this is a great segue to our kind of lab. We have to start wrapping. We can do this for hours.
We could talk to you for, we might have to bring you back, Carrie, for another episode on another topic.
We'll give you some time in between, but let the
next week work for you.
Yeah, how's your schedule look like this? The last question I have is, you know, Carrie, you see, you know, being at the BAU, you see a lot and a lot of things, and you kind of alluded to this in terms of the wins that you do see help with the coping.
Yeah, they keep you going.
But let's be honest, okay, that may only take you so far. So what do you do, Carrie, outside of the job that helps you with managing the things that you read, the things that you're researching, the things that you're exposed to? What makes you happy in your outside life? What's your favorite hobby? Are you creative? You talked about creativity. Please tell me you write like poems or something, write songs.
That's funny. You're profiling me.
I'm not, but I promise you I'm not.
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's so important to have balance. And I would say, you know, in my life, that is something that's been paramount, is to have balance. And I learned it early, you know, when I worked in a prison, that, you know, there's a certain amount of your day that's that you work and you are exposed to traumatic events or traumatic situations or content, and you have to be able to compartmentalize that and not carry it with you when you leave. So I credit my work in the prisons with really honing in on, I start my day and I end my day, and all that stuff stays there.
Oh, wow.
So for me, I very much am able to compartmentalize in that way. But it's balanced with my family and my friends and, you know, my supportive hobbies and just factors of how I kind of recharge. I am more of a, you know, just in general, like to help people, you know, I'm in that role, right? I became a psychologist, obviously, you know, I spent a lot of time learning how to help people. And so for me, when I'm not at work, I really get my direction and my recharge from my family and my friends. And again, my Minnesotans out there, right? There's key factors that I'm very anchored in. And I think all of us have to do that. So you have to be able to have really good boundaries. You have to be able to take care of yourself. Exercise is very important to me.
Yeah.
Eating right is very important to me. Trying to really take care of those key aspects that help balance, right? If you're not sleeping, that's not a good thing,
you're
right?
You're not going to be good to anyone else.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have to take care of that. And, you know, and I'm like anyone, I'm human. Sometimes I'm better at self-care than other times in my life. But again, it's recognizing that I have to make that a priority. And if I have solid focus on my family and friends and that support, then the work is balanced, right? And it's easy for me in that way. I also have, I think, the psychological kind of way that I look at things and looking at these different events that you're exposed to, being able to unpack and understand the drivers and the build, I think is helpful in processing it.
Yes. It doesn't feel as random as though these things are just happening mm-hmm. with no explanation.
Mm-hmm. I'll share a story from a former colleague of yours who had to go through a lot of the evidence of a particular horrific shooting. And although never went to the location, saw enough of the footage and the evidence where there were nightmares about lying, being underneath a desk, hiding. And that's, when I heard that story, it hurt my heart, because it's like, we have people like you and your colleagues that have to go through and really dive into these events and to understand them. But there it is hard to compartmentalize. I applaud you for being able to compartmentalize and not take those images, sounds, and all the stuff that goes with that with you. And her outlet was she would write fictional, like kind of stories, if you will. But that's how she coped with it. And I think it's an important message in terms of all of us having something outside of the job to deal with and escape from that pretty tough reality that we have to live with.
I also, another thing I'll share is that I don't just seek that content out just to seek it out, right? And so I do feel there's a cumulative effect that all of us have to be aware of and a shelf life for it. So like, for example, if we're doing a case at our unit, and there's a team that's been assigned to it, I don't need to review that type of stuff, right? If it's my job or it's my, you know, when I was had you know, a team or was involved with those cases, that was my job, fine. But I don't need to go look at my peers' cases and content, right? Unless I am a part of that team. Mm-hmm. And so that's another boundary that I have set with my own, you know, self-care and exposure. And it's something I learned from the military, actually, because if there's that cumulative effect of you know, being exposed to traumatic events and really taking care, as if you're in the military or law enforcement, not just to go and seek that out, right? We all have to do it. And that's fine, is our jobs that we've signed up to do, but we don't have to seek it out in abundance more than we're expected to do.
That's a great point. Carrie, thank you so much for joining us. We could talk for hours.
Honestly.
I know. And I cringe that we might have to cut a couple of things out for just for time purposes. But thank you so much for being our very first outside special guest.
Indeed.
We really appreciate your time.
And thank you for everything that you do. I mean, really, just for the work that you do, the research that you do, for creating this incredible model that we get to follow, and of course, for being here with us today.
I'm a fan. I'm a huge fan now. Thank you so much, Gary.
Thank you. And I just appreciate you allowing the FBI's BAU to be a part of this experience and to share this information. I do feel that knowledge is power. So again, anything we talked about, if you Google it, you'll find it. And we have the FBI.gov. And we also have, I want to give a shout out to the FBI's Prevent Mass Violence campaign.
Yes. Yes.
So if you Google Prevent Mass Violence, the FBI, you'll find that and key resources for you to know what to look for and what to do when you see those concerning behaviors.
One of the many great things about the FBI is what they publish, what you want to publish.
Great.
And put out there for
free,
the public.
Available resources.
$3.99.
Yep.
$3.99.
Best price.
So there it is.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Wow. I mean, we could have talked for hours and we couldn't, right? I mean,
well, we're trying not to make a 3.5 hour podcast.
I've never heard of those.
No, I haven't either. But, you know, maybe people will write to us and they'll tell us that's what they're really looking for.
Okay.
But I think right now we're going to try and keep it a little bit briefer. You know, we do a good job with the bulletin, keeping it to one page. And I think that's part of what people like about it.
So one page equals 1 hour?
Yeah,
is that the formula I'm hearing you say?
I think that might be our top limit.
Okay. So I think, I mean, for me, talking to Carrie and getting to know her journey, but also her research, learning about talking about creativity was so cool to me.
Yeah. Unexpected. We don't ever know where these conversations are going to go.
Right. All right, and that jumped out at us, and we were like, "Oh, we're all over that!" Like, hold on, we gotta do some cooking here on this topic of
creativity.
Without
a doubt.
So let's do that. It was so much fun.
What a fantastic guest!
I was.
She sets a high bar.
She sets a really high bar, and I was really appreciative. I know, because I was watching her. I know she was a little annoyed at Pete about the whole Silence of the Lambs thing.
Hey, at least you didn't give her a hard time about her baseball team. Yes.
I just think the public, the general public, wants to this group of profilers that are out there doing this very hard work. They want to know more about them and what inspired them, because they see it. They read about it in books. They see it in TVs. They hear it on podcasts.
Yeah, they do.
Perhaps. So I just think our audience is going to appreciate that.
Yeah. And she's doing some really amazing, difficult, as we talked about, work. But it is really exciting to get to know a little bit the kind of person behind that work. And clearly it takes a tremendous amount of passion to be able to show up to this work every day. And she's clearly got that in spades.
And what a gift she's given to the community off of their research.
I'll
it's always
tell
they,
you.
Not her, right?
Yeah.
It's a team effort.
No,
but all
right.
of her and her colleagues, all the research that they've done over the years on this very difficult topic, heavy topic of targeted violence, what a gift that is that she can share that through publications that she has, co-written, that we can then, as a community, kind of absorb and try and make the world a little bit safer.
Yeah. You know, one step at a time. But it takes people like that are willing to do that kind of hard work.
All right, Carrie, tough guest to follow.
I'll say.
The burden is on us to find good guests that continue to deliver. So that's our job.
Well, I think we're up to it. I'm looking forward to seeing what we do with this podcast and where we go next with it. And really excited to bring some of our old bulletin topics back to the forefront. And then as we start writing new ones, we're going to be pushing out new bulletin topics month after month. And
new podcast topics.
Podcasts as well. So we've got some exciting things lined up for our listeners.
I'm looking forward to it.
I am too.
Thanks for joining me on this journey. And I just...
My pleasure, Pete. It's happy to be here with you and looking forward to where we get to go with this next. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And catch us next time on Behavioral Threat Analysis Center, Beyond the Bulletin.
Take it easy. Be safe.
The views and opinions presented herein are those of the interviewer and or interviewee and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of War or its components, including Defense Counterintelligence and Security Agency, or DCSA. Further, any reference to the use of specific resources or consultation with non-government personnel does not constitute endorsement by the Department of War, its components, or DCSA.